When most people say ghetto, they mean unrefined, low class, cheap, or inferior, especially when it comes to Black people.
At least until it's co-opted by everybody else and suddenly becomes pop culture.
But we're reclaiming ghetto and rejecting white supremacist norms regarding how we're supposed to look, think, or be.
And we aren't waiting for Black ingenuity to be colonized to celebrate it. Absolute means to the largest degree possible, having unlimited power and influence, or simply unrestrained.
I'm Malcolm.
I'm Sade. And this is... Well, this is my little sister, Lola. She's about to bring it home for y'all. What this is, Lola?
This is...
Hey friends,
girl, if you don't do the intro, come on.
I'm gonna do the intro. Hello everyone, it is Hello everyone, wait. Hold on, no for real, I got it.
Okay.
This is the Absolute Ghetto.
Welcome back everyone. So we said that we were gonna do an episode on Chat with Bozeman. So we're here today to deliver what we promised, right?
Yes. So as everyone knows, Chadwick Boseman tragically passed away from colon cancer on August 28th of this year. And just for that reason, we felt it was necessary for us to talk about his impact on our lives, especially as Howard students, and his impact on the world, and how he embodies what we feel is the concept of the absolute ghetto in terms of Black creativity and excellence and leaning into your power.
All right. So today we're going to talk about why Chadwick Boseman was so special to the graduating class of 2018 of Howard University.
We're also going to talk about why his passing started a conversation about ableism and how we as a culture can do better in making the world more accessible for everybody.
We're also going to touch on different conceptions of death in different Black cultures and the implications from that.
So let's get on into it.
So let's set the scene. Like, what was going on January 20, 2018? What was the first thing you got when you arrived? The first notification you got?
Douglas exploded. And we'll explain to you what that means. Douglas Hall was one of the most popular halls on campus in terms of traffic of students from various majors and schools and backgrounds. It was just kind of like a catch-all building that a lot of students had classes in. And there was some sort of pipe that burst, and it essentially exploded. And it was actually dangerous to even be close to Douglas because of the gases that were allegedly leaking from the building. People were coming in and out of the building in hazmat suits. A lot of professors' data got destroyed, right?
And also, like, so many people, like, when you see Howard in pictures or you see people studying, you know, Howard people are beautiful. When you see them studying on Instagram, those pictures are usually in front of Douglas Hall. A lot of historical and aesthetic important to the university and to its students, to the community.
Yeah. For that to happen, as we returned from Christmas break, our senior year, our last semester at Howard, we were saddened but not surprised because it was a culmination of the BS that we had been through for the past 4 years. It was like, oh yeah, of course this would happen now because this is what Howard does. They don't take care of issues until it literally explodes. Then they're like, oh shit.
We gotta do something about this. And so, of course, that wasn't the only thing that happened. So we also have these rising tensions on campus between students and administration. Not because the thing exploding, the building exploding was its own thing. But then we also have them bringing, like, who was that lady? You know, we don't even need to say the lady's name. What is it called? The Secretary of Education, who is completely unqualified and worthless at that job.
Talking about Betsy DeVos.
I said we wasn't going to say the woman's name. was too many, like, there were so many, like, Trump administration people coming on campus that I personally lost track. Like, there was just something, I would get on social media and someone would be mad about something. And I'm out right here trying to finish my papers.
And yeah, actually, it wasn't that semester, but it was during a previous semester. Someone had actually spray painted in on the yard, "Welcome to Trump Plantation, Overseer Wayne AI Frederick," who was the president of the Howard University. So that just goes to show you. And wasn't that also, there's a sign hanging from one of the buildings that said, like, "Wayne hates black people" or something like that.
Yeah.
So it just shows students were really unhappy with how the school was handling the political changes in DC. Like, we didn't feel like they needed to be, people say, "Oh, we need to reach across the aisle, bipartisan, whatever." But how are students are like, these people are threatening our livelihood, our identities, our everything. We don't need to be collaborating with them.
Exactly.
And then rising tensions because there was a lot of controversy around mismanagement of funds. Because
they were embezzling the money, y'all. They were embezzling.
Embezzle?
of dollars. They are taking thousands of dollars of government funding from students.
We had students hashtag homeless at Howard on the news and stuff. But apparently...
Why'd you bring that up?
But apparently they embezzled funds. Like, people were mad, okay? And then, of course, I feel like if you were on social media during this time, around 2018, then you know of the scandal that came out of Howard because it blew up and went viral across the world. Mm-hmm, there's a student who was working in the financial aid office who one day a Medium article dropped and pinned him as one of the primary culprits in mismanagement of funds because apparently he had allegedly stolen like hundreds of thousands of dollars of financial aid money and used it to go on fancy vacations and all this stuff. So students were pissed about that. They were like, "Who's this guy?" Like, even though there wasn't much proof that, you know, he was actually behind, you know, all of this, people were
just he was complicit in participating.
It was the administration that allowed it to happen. It was ultimately the administration's responsibility.
Oh, and they were stealing money too. The head of financial got brought up on charges. I think they just got convicted.
Six administrators got fired.
Yeah. No, there was charges too. It was bad.
Yeah, and then just this year, another administrator just pleaded guilty to like embezzling like $500,000. Yeah, so it's still like the investigation is still ongoing, and people are still getting fired and going to jail. So abolish prisons, but y'all gotta go somewhere. But exactly. That's another episode.
That's another episode for sure. But we say all of this to say, people were fed up. Howard students, especially the senior class, we were over it, and this all came to a culmination with the students taking over the administration building. We call it the A building. It was 9 to 10 days?
It was like 9 or 10 days, yep.
Yeah, and basically
they took over the building.
There was a list of demands. There was negotiations. And a settlement was ultimately reached.
The students demanded transparency from the financial aid and the administration. They demanded more funding for certain underserviced majors and departments, and there was a lot of demands that just students felt like had been ignored for so long. And finally, after the whole scandal, and we were like viral across the world for being like the worst administration on the planet, people were like, "Okay, we're fed up because we're an excellent school. There's so much black excellence and beauty and creativity and intelligence here. We don't need to be failing this hard at something that shouldn't take you know, protests and takeovers to get accomplished." But students were fed up, so they took over the A building, and it actually was productive in many ways.
And so, just to give context, even more context, this takeover of the administration building happened days before our graduation ceremony. We're going to tie it all back together. Who ended up being the commencement speaker for our graduation?
Our commencement speaker was none other than the Chadwick Boseman. So, yes. In the midst of all this turmoil, The Black Panther was coming out, which was the it was the talk of not the town. It was the talk of the world.
Mm-hmm,
Chadwick Boseman is a Howard alum, so it was extremely exciting being a Howard student during this time. The movie was coming out in that February 2018, and everyone was just so excited to see like how he was gonna act, and you know, how's he gonna, you know, take on this role, and what's it gonna be like. And it came out, and you know, there was watch parties, and students, Howard students, had taken over different theaters, and we're in there screaming, you know, Howard, HU, you know, and like it was so exciting. And he did an amazing job, an incredible job, obviously. So when the movie came out, and he's going on this press tour, he's at the peak of his fame. He's on the radio, on the TVs, on the news, on social media every day. And then, boom, in April, it's announced he's going to be our commencement speaker.
It put things in perspective, I would say. Like, we were all super, super frustrated going into this graduation ceremony. And so we get to the graduation ceremony, and I personally am just so glad I got to go, because it was just that moment that we got to experience was something amazing. Like, it was just so invigorating. It was so encouraging. Like, Chadwick came, and he did what he had to do.
He did. The speech was incredible. It was beyond what any of us thought he was going to come and deliver. And we want to talk about some of the nuance that was in his speech. So, in his appearance on campus in the first place. So it should be noted that he didn't just come for the glory and for us to cheer for him and to be like, yes, I'm a Howard alum, big star now. He came with demands. So before he agreed to even be a commencement speaker, he demanded that the College of Fine Arts, which is the college that he graduated from, be reinstated, because it had actually been dissolved in the 90s and incorporated into the College of Arts and Sciences instead of being its own college. And in the 90s, he was actually part of the protests against the administration when they did that. So he had, you know, he already had that perspective of protesting the Howard administration. And he knew how important it is, you know, to have demands in exchange for your art and your presence and your excellence.
And so, he also connected with the protesters of today. He connected, like, I love seeing that connection of the elders with the younger generation. He was like, I'm so impressed with what you guys are doing. Like, he was like, this movement is even more organized than what we were doing. Like, he's like, I was proud of what we did back in the day, but this is even more intense and organized than what we were doing back in the day. And so he connected the past generation to the current generation at that time. And so it was just like this moment of solidarity and a reminder that this was about us pushing ourselves forward. Like, when a lot of us, when we came to Howard, this was about us embracing our Blackness. This was about us creating Black art and Black scholarship and advancing Black people, regardless of their background, across the world. That's what a lot of people came to Howard for. So he was like, if that's what we claim to be, and that's who a lot of us have been, that needs to be reflected in our administration. That needs to be reflected in how we treat our students and the people, the programs within our school. And so it was just this big, like, rallying call that we can do better, because we are better. We're, you know what I mean? It's already inside, and we just need to act on what's already there.
Yeah. And during his speech, he announced with the president that the College of Fine Arts would be reinstated. So just further affirming to us that we'd done the right thing by protesting, and that when you stand firm in your values and your beliefs, and you don't waver in them, then you can accomplish more than you could have imagined. So it was really beautiful.
It was so beautiful. It resonated so much, because he's someone who throughout his entire life and through his career has exemplified not letting himself be co-opted by white supremacy, not letting himself fall into white supremacist traps. And that all up and through his career, it's all up and through it. And so I'm super excited to talk about that.
So at the end of his speech, which I feel like I just have to mention, everyone knows Wakanda Forever was like, it was probably the most used phrase, probably the most Googled phrase during that time. I'm making that up, but Wakanda Forever was just huge across the globe because of the movie. And at the end, he did the Wakanda symbol, and he said, Howard Forever, and it was just like this beautiful moment. Everyone just broke out into cheers. Everyone stands up and they say Howard Forever. Mm-hmm. And it was just like a culmination of the 4 years, all the BS we'd been through, all the trials and tribulations we'd gone through, all the ups and downs. It was like that moment seeing Chadwick Boseman, a Howard alumni who was at the peak of his career, and not only the peak of his career, but also using his influence to make a difference, like to stand in solidarity with us and say mm-hmm. Howard Forever. It was just like the light at the end of the tunnel. It was like that push we needed to just go forward and take the world by storm. And it was just beautiful. So thank you, Chadwick, for coming to speak to us. We appreciate you so much for your impact on us as Howard students. And now we're going to talk a little bit more about your impact throughout the world.
So we're going to talk about Chadwick Boseman's acting career and something that he talked about in the speech. So like when he first started off, he was like trying to get his foot in the door, and he got this role on a soap opera as a gang member. And the way the script was written, there was a lot of questionable things, some anti-black things going on. And so he could have just stood by and like not questioned. He could have not like raised the fuss about it to protect his career, to make sure that he kept progressing. But he couldn't let that stand. He couldn't let that go by on his watch. And so he went to the producers and the people in charge, and he was like, I have some questions and also some suggestions, because he was a pro. Like, he has studied acting and studied production, all of that type of stuff. And he was like, here's a way we can make this character more culturally relevant and impactful. And they weren't trying to meet his demands. And so he had to depart. He couldn't do it. And, mm-hmm. you know, there was a fear he talked about in the speech. There was a fear of, like, was that it? Like, am I going to be blackballed? Am I not going to be able to get any more jobs? Which mm-hmm. is important. But he was like, he had to stand on his principles. He had to stand on who he was. And of course, we all know that that is not how the story ended for Chadwick Boseman's acting career. And so what happened after that?
I mean, he committed himself to taking on roles that he felt represented the Black community in a more positive and accurate light. And he just kept doing smaller roles until he landed much bigger roles. And he ended up playing some of the most influential Black people ever.
Right. Like all of them.
So James Brown in Get On Up, Thurgood Marshall in Marshall, Jackie Robinson in 42, the African Samurai, Yasuke.
Yeah, he was playing it. That was actually one of the last projects, and he had just finished recording the pre-production before he passed. But he was like, I'm about to play all of the major Black roles. And of course
we all know that the biggest role that he played and what his representative said was the honor of his career mm-hmm. Was the Black Panther. And the Black Panther's impact was incredible. Something that I really took from the film was how it symbolizes the epitome of Black innovation, technology, creativity, and also culture, and how all of those merge together. Mm-hmm. For example, spirituality is a huge aspect of many African cultures, and they drew from different African traditions to sort of create the folklore behind this fictional country that was Wakanda, but they stayed true to the essence of African culture and creativity, in the sense that there was a very spiritual aspect even to Wakanda, which was supposed to be like 200, 300 years ahead of its time in terms of technology, but they merged that with spirituality. And vibranium, for example, had and vibranium dust, vibranium sand, had a spiritual aspect to it. Mm-hmm. There's a whole legend behind why vibranium was so strong and why the Black Panther was so powerful. Vibranium was like a merging of the spiritual and the technology, which African technology and advancements that Africans have made in technology are often overlooked, like in real life. Mm-hmm. And the spiritual aspect of African tradition is well known to a lot of people, but I just thought it was beautiful how they sort of merged the two and to make the Black Panther's power be one that was not only technical but also spiritual, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. in African traditions we really believe, and I say we because I am half Nigerian, we really believe in harnessing power through your spirituality, mm-hmm. through your connection with the spiritual world. So
that's so beautiful that this country, this fictional country of Wakanda, that like it was ahead of the world, not because they used white supremacist paradigms. It was something that was very authentically Black, very authentically African. And mm-hmm. they used African ways of knowing the world and of knowing God and of knowing power to advance their civilization that was built into the framework of this fictional world. And I thought that was so beautiful. And actually, in an article that I read, they were talking about how they wanted the Wakandans to have British accents, which is
ridiculous.
And so Chadwick Boseman, he said, absolutely not. What are y'all doing? And he was very instrumental in advocating for the accent that you ended up seeing in the movie, the African, which is actually like a mixture of different African accents, because again, it's a fictional world for the most part. And Chadwick Boseman was very instrumental in this process. It really reflected different aspects of Black culture. And that's part of why it resonated with so many people. I saw the movie like 3 times. I saw it like by myself one time. I saw it with one group of friends. I saw it with Sade. Like I saw it with a whole bunch of different people. It was just such a powerful moment. And so, and again, like someone that wasn't sure if they were going to keep getting acting gigs, you know what I mean? Because they pissed off the white people. And he was like, you know what? If that's what it's going to be, that's what it's going to be. But it shows that your gift is going to, one, make room for you. And two, that like when you are authentic to yourself, you get to say something interesting. Like Chadwick Boseman and the way that he portrayed Black Panther and the creative contributions he made to the production of Black Panther is part of why it's so influential to this day. That's just, again, the epitome of the absolute ghetto. It's like, no, we don't let white people tell us what we can and can't do. We don't let white people tell us what is and what isn't legitimate. We speak for ourselves. We reach into our own culture. We reach into our own power and we move forward.
Right. He wasn't just an actor who did what they told him to do. Mm-hmm. He made sure that he did right by Black people, and it was going to tell an authentic tale. Not in the sense that it was a true story, but in the sense that it was reflective of the African diaspora, which was extremely important to him. So something that we found out when he tragically passed away was that he was actually battling colon cancer for 4 years. So that was while he was filming the Black Panther and all of these other huge roles that he had done. He was battling colon cancer. So that made me and Malcolm think about the conversation that sort of swirled after his passing about ableism.
Yeah, so it's a really complex issue because so there's one aspect of like the working conditions of people who have disabilities and how accessible the world is to people in general. Like one of the big questions that I don't know the answer to is, would he have been able to get that role if he had made it public that he was battling this condition and right. people knowing that it could kill him and the impacts that it would weaken his body?
And I feel like probably not.
Yeah, and so there's that aspect of it. And then there's also, and like people, this is not to like, you know, put people down. Like I get why they were doing it, but I saw these sentiments on the internet of people saying, you know, look at what Chadwick did. We don't have any excuses. And that could be very, very dangerous to people who are facing debilitating conditions. The answer is not for us to tell those people to try harder. The answer is to make the world more accessible, because it really ends up helping us all. There's, you know, I do research. Like, there's papers on this. It's beneficial. When you have the rant for people, that ends up helping civilization as a whole. So it actually is better. Well, first of all, I think it's just a moral right thing to do to make the world more accessible. But then also, there's benefits, there's externalities for everybody.
That makes me think about, like, you know, creating a more accessible world, whether that be healthcare or you know, workplace discrimination, or eliminating workplace discrimination and things like that. Is that something that disabled people would appreciate in terms of being able to more easily mask their disability? And the reason why that makes me think about that is because Chadwick Boseman, like, had obviously wanted to hide his disability. He did, maybe he felt like he couldn't get certain jobs if, you know, they knew he had cancer, or maybe he just wanted to be very private, but for whatever his reasons were, his ability to hide it benefited him in many ways. I wonder if Chadwick appreciated being able to mask his cancer, because it afforded him to be able to do things that maybe he wouldn't have been able to do. But I also wonder if that was a burden on him, in the sense that, you know, maybe he wanted, you know, that support, like, from his community. I'm thinking about how when he was losing a lot of weight earlier this year and people didn't know he had cancer, of course, the internet is going to internet. And, you know, there's people, you know, making fun of him for losing all that weight and saying, the Crack Panther, so, and all these mean, horrible things. Which, if I see someone losing weight, like, I'm not even gonna say nothing. Like, I'm just gonna pretend I didn't even notice, honestly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some people aren't as sensitive to things like that. So, you know, I wonder if he wished he could have been open about his diagnosis, because one, it could have shielded him from some of the ridicule, but also just, like, that support system. You know, like, is it, you know, would it have been better for him to be able to be open with his fan base about that? I don't know, you know?
And I really wonder if, like, how we can make it where it's a choice. Like, I imagine from what his estate and what people who are close to him have said, that doing these roles really meant a lot to him. It was something that he wanted to do. And so it's like, how do we create an environment where they can do what they want to do, and they're supported? Again, like what Sade's talking about, they have that support to do what they want to do, but also people who don't want to do that, you know what I mean? That there's not this pressure on them to perform in this capitalistic sense, or to produce in a way that they feel like they should be producing. Like, I feel like with the virus is really exposing to us, like, how being sick and not being able to navigate certain spaces, like, how it's just really, the world is not set up for you. Like, the attendance policies in school, in grade school, those are ableist. Like, if you have a chronic illness and you're punishing students for not being able to show up and be, or even if they have some type of condition where it's hard for them to be attentive all the time, and you're trying to penalize the kids because you feel like they're supposed to be this certain way. Like, that's kind of tying it back to with Chadwick Boseman and people who may be in a similar situation. Like, how do we get to a place where there's not this pressure for them to appear quote unquote normal in order for them to keep moving forward?
Do we have any answers?
You know, I think we should do an episode on
ableism as a whole
and how it's very much linked to the Black experience. Again, Chadwick did amazing things, but, like, how do we make sure that, like, Chadwick and, like, other people in that situation are properly supported?
Yeah. Oh, something else I wanted to mention was a lot of people may remember when he was doing his press tours for the Black Panther, and a lot of times there would be fans he would take photos with, or he would do red carpet photos or press or whatever, and people would always he would have to do the Wakanda symbol, or people would come up to him and ask him to do it with them. So he takes selfies of people doing the Wakanda symbol, or with groups of kids, or all that stuff. And people would look at the pictures, and they would always look at his eyes and his expression and be like, he looks like he's exhausted, he looks like he wants to go home.
Yeah, I remember that.
Be there. They're like, Chad looks like he is over it. I realized, like, once he passed away, he was literally battling cancer, colon cancer during those times, maybe doing, maybe coming from chemotherapy, coming from different treatments, rehabilitation. Who knows what he had been doing even the day before he was going to some of these events and stuff like that. And so it was just more even eye-opening just to realize how selfless he was throughout that time. Mm-hmm. You know, to keep showing up for us and to keep inspiring us and to inspire the kids and to do all these things. And, you know, that had to be absolutely exhausting while he was battling this illness. Mm-hmm. And it's just another reason to just, I mean, people were saying, you know, after he passed away, you know, you don't know what people are going through, you know, be kind. But really, it shouldn't even have to be like, oh, because they might be going through something, just be kind. But to me, that was just another realization I had about him, that his character, that mm-hmm, he mm-hmm. was probably battling all of these things. He had a disability and he was still showing up and he was tired. You could see that he was tired, you know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's sad to think that he couldn't, maybe in some ways he couldn't fully enjoy his moment, because of his illness. But it's just another reason why we need to find ways to make the world more easy to navigate and to thrive and prosper in for disabled people. We really want to break down the different perspectives on death that are seen throughout the African diaspora and the world as a whole.
And of course, it's good to start with yourself when you're trying to take on a task so big. And mm-hmm. so I grew up in the Black church, and so I lived in, like, the South. Like, I grew up in California, in Connecticut, in Florida. And so there's different experiences, and we were always in the Black churches in those different places. And kind of how we thought about death was similar. Like you said, it definitely ties into, like, the death not being the end, and that someone's spirit still stays with you and, like, can help guide you and is kind of like this supportive force for you. And also that these spirits get to experience peace. Like, it was often like when someone was about to pass, especially if they were dealing with something that was painful, that they were able to rest. Like they were untethered from physical pain. And so that's kind of like my personal experience with how my cultural reference for like how I thought about death. What was yours?
So obviously, I feel like my perspective on death was influenced by both, you know, growing up in America, but also being half Nigerian. Very two different perspectives in a way. Like growing up in America, you know, death is a pretty sad occasion, you know, regardless of the culture, depending on the culture. But in most cultures, you know, death isn't necessarily a happy occasion, but mm-hmm. In America, it's much more like, you know, you wear all black to the funeral. Mm-hmm. It's very solemn. There's lots of crying and the funeral service, and you know, just a lot of, you know, huddling in corners and whispering and patting people on the back and just, you know, just a lot of consoling and just, like, you know, really, really embracing your grief, I feel like, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. is good in many ways. On the other hand, being Nigerian, Nigerian funerals and Nigerian homegoings, I mean, they don't even really call them funerals. It's more like a homegoing. Mm-hmm. Nigerian mm-hmm. homegoings are more of like a celebration, even a party. Like when I remember my dad's mom passed away, and she lived mm-hmm. in Nigeria, Lagos, Nigeria, her whole life. And she came to visit us a couple times. So, and we came to visit her once, I think, before she passed in Nigeria. But so I didn't know her extremely well. She didn't really speak much English, so we couldn't communicate and on a deep level. But, you know, I still had a connection to her as my grandmother. So mm-hmm. I remember when she passed away, my parents came and picked us up from school early. And they sat us down in the living room, and they, you know, they let us know that, yeah, my dad's dead. My dad's mom had passed away. And this was his last living parent, as his dad had passed away when he was a little boy. So I remember just seeing the pain in his eyes, and, you know, him trying to hold back tears and just, like, you know, be strong and not break down in front of us. But so I actually want to tell you a little story, Malcolm, about a dream my dad told me about right before we left for his mom's homegoing.
Tell me more.
So a couple of days before we were taking our flight to Lagos, Nigeria, he sat me down in the living room, and, you know, he was talking to me about, you know, the grief he'd been going through and the pain he'd been in. And mind you, I'm like 9 or 10 years old. So I'm like, you know, like, I didn't know my grandmother that well because she didn't really speak English. I didn't see her that much because she lived in Lagos. But, you know, I'm just trying to understand all this going on. Right. So I guess he wanted to help me understand what's going on too, on a deeper level, you know? So he's talking to me about his grief, and he told me about the nightmares he's been having. And because he was so, you know, devastated that both of his parents, you know, had passed away. And he told me that a couple of nights before, he had a dream where he saw his mom come to him in a light. And this wasn't a nightmare. This was a dream. It was like a good dream. But at the beginning of the dream, he's crying. He's in grief. And he sees his mom's face, like, come through the light. And she's just smiling and laughing. And he keeps crying, and he's looking at her, and he's trying to, like, reach out to her. And he's like, "Mom, why? Like, he's just asking her why. You know, why did you go? Like, no, I need you." And she just looks at him, and she starts dancing, and she starts laughing and dancing. And you know, Nigerian, like, dancing is in Nigerian culture, dancing is just like a way that you express joy and happiness and peace. So she's dancing, and he keeps crying, like, "Mom, no, like, why are you dancing? Like, I need you to come back," you know. And she just looked at him, and she smiled, and she laughed, and she just danced. And she just danced back into the light, you know, out of his vision. And he said when he woke up, he just felt like this peace come over him. And that was, I remember that so distinctly because I was so young, and that set me up, you know, that put everything in perspective for me going into the celebration of life. You know, it was unlike funerals that I'd been to before. And my grandmother, who was now an ancestor, had come to my dad and literally told him, expressed to him through her dancing, that she was at peace, and she was joyful, and she was happy, and she was in a better place. And to me, that just exemplifies exactly, you know, what we're saying when we say that African cultures often have perceptions of death that are a lot different than Western cultures. And that, for example, in Nigeria, if you've lived long and you had a successful life and you've made an impact on a lot of people, it's considered like an elevation, like, instead of, like, you know, lowered into the ground, like, you're elevating into a realm that's even higher than we could imagine on Earth. And it's a joyful thing. So that's just something that I felt was amazing that my ancestor now confirmed to me and my family. She literally came to us to confirm it.
That is so beautiful. Like, I feel so warm right now just hearing that story. Thank you so much for sharing.
Of course. And I hope you guys enjoyed that too. So, of course, it's still a sad, tragic thing when somebody you love passes away. But going to Nigeria for the funeral was an eye-opening experience, because I really saw what they meant by celebration of life. Like my dad said when we were going, he said, "Okay, we're going to our celebration of life. It's not a funeral." And we did, you know, do traditional funeral things. Like, there was a service where we sat and we remembered her life and all that stuff. And we, you know, went and viewed the body, which was all beautifully made up and adorned. But that was, like, one day out of the entire funeral. When the funeral was, like, a week long, mind you. Or I think I keep saying funeral by habit, but it's a celebration of life, really. But what was the bulk of her homegoing was celebrating her life. So, I mean, even more than we sat and we mourned, we danced, had scheduled, or we had booked an extremely popular Nigerian gospel artist named Yinka Yefele. He was actually disabled. He was in a wheelchair from, I think a car accident.
Wow.
Paralyzed. So, he definitely had a testimony. So he was extremely successful touring in a wheelchair. So that's a powerful testament to what disabled people are able to do in and of itself. But yeah, Yinka Yefele, he was the performer for the big party at the end. And I just remember we were all dancing and it was like crazy. I think it was the first time that we were dancing and people just started putting money on me and dollars and money on me and stuff. And I was like, okay, wait. So I kept dancing and people kept putting money on me. I was like, oh shit, this is what we're doing here. So I think that's one of the first times that I ever experienced the Nigerian tradition that, you know, dancing, people kind of make it rain on you. just to show appreciation for your dance and your talent and showing your creativity and the way you move. It's just something they do. But this is a celebration of life. This is technically a funeral, you know?
Right.
But we're partying into the night. I'm talking, it's 2 a.m. We are partying and the kids are partying. It's old people partying. There's a lot of people there who did not know my grandmother. You know, they were just there to party.
It was for real a party. In my experience as an African American, the most recent example I'm thinking of is Aretha Franklin's funeral. And it was 8 hours. It wasn't multiple days. But they had all of the biggest talents there. You know, I think it's interesting, hearing about, I haven't been to a Nigerian funeral, especially not in Nigeria. But, it reminds me of, kind of every single funeral that I've ever been to in my lifetime. They always say, you know that auntie wouldn't want us sitting around crying. She would want us to be having a good time because that's what she used to do.
You know when people party, after someone dies and they pour one out for the dead homie?
Yep.
Is it because it's like, cause it's like he likes to party, so we gonna pour him a shot too, and they pour it on the ground, you know. So it's all connected. So going back to the whole concept of African funerals and Nigerian funerals, aka celebrations of life, when someone has lived a long and successful, fulfilling life, then that's really highlighted in their homegoing ceremonies, and it's considered less of a tragic event, their passing, when it's considered that, oh, they did a lot with their life, they were successful, they were happy and fulfilled, and they accomplished a lot. And I feel like personally growing up, I saw that reflected in my father's attitude towards death. For example, I may go into this deeper at another time, but when I was in middle school, he was attacked at his office and was actually stabbed multiple times and held at gunpoint and robbed of his valuable like that. And the robber had tied him up and, you know, had a gun to his head and was going to take him and put him in the trunk. A trunk of his car to go withdraw money from a bank. And then my dad just inferred that after he did that, he'll go take him to the woods somewhere or something like that and shoot him in the head and kill him. And when I asked my dad, what it was like being in that moment, and luckily he did escape, he fought back and he broke the rope and he managed to escape with his life. But when I asked him how he felt about it, he had told me that he, as he realized what was about to happen, he started to make peace with the fact that he was about to die and that he realized he lived a long, successful life. And he was probably in his early 40s around this time. He said he lived a long, successful life. He'd done a lot. He had beautiful children. He had a beautiful wife. He had a business. He had accomplished, you know, everything that he had set out to accomplish as a young impoverished boy from Lagos, Nigeria, who grew up in the slums. I mean, as you know, I'm kind of the persuasion of no, we aren't accepting death around here. We throw hands with death. We square up. Hands. We
COVID. We throwing hands with COVID. We throwing hands with cancer.
he felt like he'd done so much that he could make peace with the fact that he was about to die. And it was actually the thought of us, his young children, having to live without him that made him get the energy to finally fight back, because he realized, you know, we need him. We need him. We need him to be that influence for us and encourage us to be successful and grow and fulfill our dreams. But it wasn't about him as much as it was about us, the decision to fight back. It was to be, it was for us, you know?
So I feel like that kind of, I'm very curious, like, especially like in the wake of COVID, like how does how we conceptualize death influence how we deal with this time when so many people are dying needlessly? Like, they're not dying because they're supposed to. And it's kind of like, I feel like there's not dignity to it because it's being done. It's being orchestrated. You know what I mean? It's not something that's happening passively. There's limits to what we can do sometimes. And like, sometimes things don't go the way that we want them to. But at the same time, like, you take care of each other as much as you can. And like, there's a difference between, you know, you did everything in your power to help someone and they just didn't make it and you just watched them die. And so that's kind of like what I'm struggling with personally in this time, is that this feels very much, not it feels, I can back it up with data. We know that the president knew the severity of this virus. He knew measures that he could have taken to minimize the harm that was done. And also we see from examples of other countries that there were many effective measures to dealing with this. And they like so gleefully and actively participated in our death. They basically used this as a means to kill us, almost, is what it feels like. And so I'm very frustrated, and I'm trying to think about, like, you know, like, all of these people have died and I want to pay respect to them and I want to celebrate their lives. But in my opinion, they were robbed. They were robbed by Donald Trump. They were robbed by all of the people who have sat by idly, who had power and let this happen. And so what are you thinking?
We got beef and it's on site. We shouldn't be accepting anyone in our community dying a needless death, dying an early death, dying an untimely death from something that could be prevented. So the fact that we're just watching it happen on an enormous scale, we're past 200,000 deaths in the U.S. now. We passed over a million cases a long time ago. I don't even know how many cases we were at now.
I think
now,
it's near 2 million now.
New 2 million now? Yeah. And it's just crazy. I mean, 9/11 just passed, and we always think about, all the people that died in 9/11, that was... was it 2,000? It was between 2,000 and 3,000 people that died in 9/11.
Yeah.
I think it was close to 3,000 people. What's 2,000 divided by 3,000? Let's do the math real quick. because...
I may be into economics, but I am not not a arithmetic person.
Divided by...
Need my calculator.
This is not perfect, but... oh my god, not this, not the devil appearing, because why does it say 66.666666?
See?
The devil is a liar.
The spirits are trying to tell you, that it's plants, you know what I mean? That it's something that, I mean, we know for a fact that, again, Donald Trump specifically let people die, that he knew that people were going to die and that he could have done something
right.
about it.
The recordings came out a couple weeks ago that showed him talking about how he was going to play down the virus, and he knew how serious it was, but he wants to play it down for his own personal gain. And also, just, he said not to freak people out, but you need to freak people out about something that can kill hundreds and thousands of them. Duh, like, are you stupid? But yeah, he is. We know that. But we knew that. So,
it's so sad and frustrating. And so it's like...
And then that, when you multiply the impact of that by the impact of the police brutality that we've experienced this year and witnessed this year, it becomes even more poignant, like, how under attack the Black community is. And it's been hard to grapple with as a young Black person trying, you know, coming up in the world and, you know, trying to find their purpose and their niche and how they're going to make an impact and, you know, find their destiny. It's difficult watching all these people your age, older, younger, die tragic early deaths. Even colon cancer, what Chadwick Boseman passed away from, is more prevalent among Black men. Mm-hmm. So there's even nuances there in terms of the effects on the Black community. We saw conversations happening about, you know, Black men going to get tested earlier if they can for different cancers because seen the prevalence of these cancers higher in certain African-American communities. And yeah, I feel like this year has just been just Black death upon Black death upon Black death. And it's been death in general. But just seeing the ways that it affects the Black community acutely is just so devastating because it's like we're fighting a war on so many fronts. And they all in all of these wars want us to die. You know, like we're fighting like, you know, viruses. We're fighting white supremacy. We're fighting just like just the system as a whole. Mm-hmm. And it's like constantly waking up every day being like, how am I going to survive today? Because I mean,
I just feel like I want to reach to the people who came before me and who fought. Because it's there's certain things that can't be prevented. There's certain things that we do have the power to affect. And so I want to be a part of the process of combating some of these forces that are accelerating the deaths of Black people. I think we're going to go ahead and pay respect to, of course, throughout this episode, we've been paying respect to Chadwick Boseman, rest in power, to our fellow Bison. But I also just want to pay respect to all of these Black lives that have been lost around the world. And in the United States, to this virus, to state violence, to all of it. Because those people, even if we know their name or not, they matter. Their lives matter. They meant something to someone else. They were a part of these communities. They were artists. They were leaders. They were engineers. They were whatever. We throw around these numbers all the time of Black people dying. At least in the work that I've been doing, constantly being exposed to numbers of Black people dying from the virus. And they're not just numbers, they're people who lived rich lives. And so I just want to acknowledge those people and to create space for them now. So I guess we'll just take a little bit of time to like acknowledge those people. Rest in power. In the spirit of the homegoing service, yeah, they wouldn't want us sitting here being sad. They would want us to use joy in our expression to. It's part of our point, our power moving forward. It's part of like our ability to navigate all of this going on. And so I definitely, I guess since we talked about something very serious and somber, what's something that is bringing you joy?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
Something that's bringing me joy? Oh my god. Doing this podcast with you is bringing me joy.
Is that lame? No, I think I was going to be my answer. You stole my answer. But I'm just so grateful to have made, one of the things that I got from my Howard experience is that I made lifelong friends, who have helped me so much personally, professionally, spiritually. And so I'm just thankful for community. I'm thankful that even with all of this struggle and everything that we go through, that we're not alone. And so this podcast is like a part of that process to me of like us working together and celebrating each other. And so I'm extremely grateful. So exactly. I second what you're saying. And so
thank you.
I encourage everyone to create space for that anger and that frustration, but also always create space for joy and for celebrating the lives that we have now that we're still here. And so, I think we've done enough.
Yeah. So thank you guys for joining us. We hope that you got all your ghetto needs today. We always want to shout out a Black organization at the end of our episode. So today we are going to do
Advancing Health Equity. So Advancing Health Equity's primary mission is to engage with healthcare and related organizations around bias and racism in healthcare, with the goal of mobilizing for health equity and eradicating racialized health inequities. They are led by Dr. Uche Blackstock, and they've been doing amazing work, so we're super happy to shout them out.
Yeah, and check out Dr. Uche Blackstock's social media, because she has been getting a lot of attention due to the way she's addressed the COVID-19 pandemic on her social medias. Information in the show notes and her IG and anything we can find. So you should definitely check her out and learn something. Love y'all. Stay ghetto.
If you guys really enjoyed the show, we would love it if you told a friend, you told a friend to tell a friend to check us out. And yeah, stay ghetto. This is